Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 12 for August 18th. We got a bunch of interesting stories this week. We had a lot of big news that came out, and we have a guest with us too. So just to start off, I'll be your host this week, David O'Brien, and with me,
Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David Liu.
So the three big stories that came out are Microsoft and Eye for Eye and their patent dispute. There's also another interesting story about a bit of a website fiasco between two law firms. And finally, we're going to cover the real DVD case that's been going on in the courts. So starting off with the first story, we have this big Microsoft ruling that came down this week. Microsoft has apparently been permanently enjoined from selling their Word products. And this all ties into a patent dispute that's been going on since 2007 against, and it was filed by this company called Eye for Eye, and the suit was filed down in the Eastern District of Texas. Eye for Eye is a Canadian company, and they claim to have a patent that Microsoft has been infringing basically for the last couple of years. So there's a lot going on here, and it's probably best to start off with the patent itself. Ben, do you want to kind of explain what's going on in the patent?
Absolutely. So the patent's, just to be clear, it's a U.S. patent that this company owns, and it's for, reading off the patent, a computer system for the manipulation of architecture and content of a document. David Liu does research on this kind of thing. He's a computer science PhD student at St. Louis University, so David Liu, feel free to chime in at any time. Essentially, this is a patent that covers editing the form of a document separate from the content of the document, which is essentially what XML and even HTML is. It's the idea of, you know, separating the form of what content looks like based on what content contains. One more clarification. This isn't the subject of David Liu's research. David Liu is currently researching bioinformatics, but this computer science is kind of his game. So did I get in most of the things that you wanted in that explanation?
Yeah, I think we got some of the key elements here. So what is Eye for Eye really disputing against Microsoft?
So Microsoft's the latest version of Word contains the DocX format, which is a open XML-based format for their documents to make them theoretically more easily editable, although I'm going to contest that in the basis of every time somebody's ever sent me and other people an email containing a DocX format, there's always an email back saying, can you send this in not DocX because nobody can open DocX currently, except for people who had owned this version of Word. But I digress. Essentially, they're saying that the Microsoft's ability to edit and open these XML files violates their patent, which covers that kind of document, which covers editing that kind of document specifically.
Right. So we've got about 20 different types of claims in there. And is it safe to call this a software patent?
Yes. Yes, it is. It covers a computer system, like I said, a computer system for the manipulation of that. It's not tied to any specific hardware. It raises a question as to whether or not, since it's not tied to any specific hardware, whether or not it's patentable. But this is an issue that's going to be decided by the Supreme Court next term, and there's not a whole lot of going into that because we really don't know where this is going to end up.
Okay, so I mean, just to back up a little bit, I think a lot of people sort of question these types of patents when they see them, because if you look at these 20 claims, they're very confusingly written, and they're very broad too. Nowhere, anywhere in the patent does it mention anything about DocX or XML, but it does sort of describe, as it describes in the patent, a computer system for manipulating documents that seem to have those types of characteristics. So the patent itself was issued in 1998. How far back does the XML standard go, and when was it created? I mean, I think the question that a lot of people might have, well, you know, in the U.S., you need to have invented the actual invention that you're claiming in your patent. Is it possible that somebody else had invented, basically came out with something similar to XML before this patent was issued?
It is.
Or before it was invented?
It seems that the actual dispute is not over the XML so much as the actual method for storing the XML. So Microsoft is using this Office Open XML to store their documents these days, which is the DocX format. And the nice part about it is that it is this open standard, which anybody can use. So while older programs such as Word might not be able to handle the format, other programs now can read what the actual document is saying based on the published standard. And so the actual problem is different, or how the XML is actually stored. So it goes back to the sort of form versus content idea that Ben mentioned earlier, where the actual text contained in the XML is stored in one place and the formatting is stored in another place, which I believe is what I4I is claiming their patent is based on.
Right. David?
Yeah, no, that's I think that's a great take on exactly what the patent itself is covering. And I want to say that I don't think a lot of people anticipated that, you know, Microsoft would ever be permanently enjoined from selling its versions of, I think it goes Word 2003, 2007, and portions also, I think, of Vista, which utilize that type of storage mechanism for XML. Now this permanent injunction has been issued. And how did the permanent injunction, Ben, come out, and what was sort of the aftermath of this case?
So a jury found that Microsoft had infringed these patents. And after the jury found that, the company I4I moved for a preliminary injunction to get Microsoft. So to back up for a second, after a patent is found to be infringed by a jury or a judge, if it's, say, summary judgment or a bench trial, which are just two other ways of resolving a case, there are two things that can happen. The judge can issue a permanent injunction, which will prevent Microsoft from ever selling an infringing product again. Or the judge can set a reasonable licensing fee, so that for every copy, and this is a mandatory licensing fee, so that every copy of Word or any infringing product that Microsoft sells or includes on a computer, they have to pay I4I a certain amount. And that's what happened here.
That's similar to a royalty scheme, right?
Right. It actually is. I guess it's exactly the same as a royalty. I don't know.
You're forcing the licensure in the end of the day of the IP, right?
Right, you are. So that's essentially what happened here. I4I asked the judge to, instead of forcing a royalty, instead of forcing a payment, they asked for... Excuse me, I had to mute so I could cough. They asked the judge for a permanent injunction to just stop the sales, presumably so they could either go back to Microsoft and try to negotiate with, you know, a bigger sledgehammer against Microsoft, you know, say, well, you know, now there's a permanent injunction, so we've got all the bargaining chips, or so that they could then instead use their patent to develop a competing product, which I'm sure would be very successful against Microsoft Word.
So we normally don't hear a lot about permanent injunctions. We usually see a lot of preliminary injunctions. What's the difference?
A preliminary injunction is issued in a case in the very beginning, and it lasts until the case is resolved. A permanent injunction is issued after the end of the case and lasts as long as it's enforced by the court. In this case, it would last until the expiration of the patent, which would be, 20 years from filing, so 2014? 17 years from filing?
I thought it was issued in...
Issued in 98. I'm going to go back and check on this. I'll put something in the show notes.
Oh, don't forget that the patent term was extended in somewhere in that time period from 17 years to 20 years, right?
Yeah, but when it changed from 17 to 20 years, it went from date of issuance from date of filing. So,
right.
And I just don't remember what that date is. It may be 95. So if it may be 20 years from filing. It may be 20 years from – 17 years from – I don't know. I'll figure it out.
In any event, the patent is going to be up in a few years, basically.
Right. Either way, it doesn't have much time left.
But that's assuming that Microsoft doesn't come out with another version of Word for 2017.
So the big thing here is, like, how does Microsoft get around this? Is there any way that they can get around this? I mean, do they completely have to stop selling their products just because it has this capability?
No. Well, they do have to stop selling this product under this code base. If they do not change the code, they have to stop selling this product. They cannot. They would be in contempt of court, which would be a huge mess for Microsoft. But they can try to change the code to invent around it, which is one of the great features of the U.S. patent system. So if there's a patent in place, you can try to make your invention so that it doesn't actually infringe all of the all the restrictions in the patent. It doesn't actually practice all of the limitations. So if I had a patent for a sandwich that said the sandwich contains a top slice of bread, a filling, and a bottom slice of bread, and you make an open-faced sandwich, then you're not infringing my patent because you've found a way to invent around it. You only have a bottom slice and a filling.
Okay, so...
David Liu, does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, okay. Just generally the progressive nature of the patents makes sense.
So in terms of Microsoft's technical capabilities, as I understand it, DocX, as of Word 2007, is the default document type setting. Is that right?
I believe it is.
I don't use Word 2007, so I don't actually know myself.
Oh, 2007? No, I don't. David Liu, do you use it? I'm a Mac guy.
And I'm a Linux guy, but
hey.
I think it is... Yeah, it's in Word 2007, I believe. So.
Yeah, so, and, I mean, that would make sense based on how frequently I get sent it. I'm pretty sure it's the default.
So they've sold, Microsoft has sold tons of software, basically, that has this capability. And what happens to them? I mean, do they have to be now, does Microsoft have to go back and either reissue some type of a patch that would, you know, prevent, you know, the reading and writing to XML-type documents?
No, I don't believe they do. The judgment was structured, it seems that all of the damages for past practice and continued practice of this patent. Well, okay, so even thinking about this for a second, even if, as long as Microsoft does not sell any more of these, they're no longer infringing the patent. And that's all that matters from Microsoft's standpoint. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So I think if I'm reading the final judgment here correctly, first of all, we never mentioned the actual numbers. So they were awarded, Eye for Eye was awarded $40 million in punitive damages and $200 million in compensatory damages. And I think they were also additionally awarded attorney's fees and costs. Is that right, Ben, on the attorney's fees and costs?
I believe so, or at least some measure of that.
So no small damage awards, but I believe that I think that these damages here are actually going to the past infringements that were going on. Why is that number so large? That's $240 million is a huge number.
So part of that was an increase for willful infringement. And just like with copyright infringement, if the infringer knew or should have known of this patent, you can get extra damages tacked on, and obviously in this case the jury found that. But that only actually accounted for $40 million of the verdict here. I really have no idea why it's so big. It's a massive, massive number. I mean, we don't have details on, you know, how much it sold for, what Microsoft profits were, how essential this is. So that is one of the factors. And these are all things that would go into determining how much proper damages are.
Right, so I think the court came out and they had basically said that this was like a grossly willful infringement that Microsoft continued to do successively over a period of years. And it was so bad during those periods of years. And the willful issue, I think, so Microsoft tried to challenge it after the jury had reached its verdict. And they filed what's called a judgment as a matter of law, something we talked about, I think, either last week or the week before. But basically they're asking the court to say that, you know, the jury should not have concluded that this was willful infringement. And willful infringement essentially means where one of the parties had, or the defendant had, a reason to know or actually did know that his practices were infringing the patent. And that's what sort of what gives rise to the issue of treble damages. And I think based on those two things, the period of time that the infringement had going on, and given the nature of the patent and how it was, you know, it appeared that basically Microsoft had been reading off of the patent in its through its software, that sort of merited the $200 million in compensatory. So you have to assume that I4I would have, what would I4I have gotten in terms of royalties if they had licensed that technology to Microsoft over that term of years, and what should they have had to put them back in the right spot?
Right. So actually, you hit on a big part of patent law there, David, which is that there are two ways you can measure damages in these patent cases. What you just said is the reasonable royalty, or essentially what Microsoft's profits were from the use of the patent. And my guess is that, I mean, either one probably would have come to a big number, but Microsoft's profits, I'm guessing, would be the better way to go about it in this case, because you've got a product that's going to have a lot of sales. It's usually a high-value product. Of the things in the Office suite, it's going to be the most used. So that's going to have an important, you know, it's going to have weight in how much people are paying for the Office suite. And it was also an advertised feature. And when you get into patent cases, if you have an advertised feature, what's sometimes called a box feature, you know, something that's on the box as, you know, this is, you know, a selling point of the product that's covered by a patent, that's a very good way to attack it and say, you know, when you're going to the jury, you know, this was an important feature that they infringed upon. This was so important that they advertised it on their product. So we should get, you know, so many cents or such a percent for every of the product, every widget sold, or in this case, every version of Word that was sold.
Do you guys have a sense on how the actual willfulness of Microsoft's infringement is actually established?
Well, yeah. So the court basically, well, it's basically a determination on the evidence before the jury, and so the jury will initially make that determination. And in this case, it's a little bit funny, like I mentioned before. So the jury came down and said, okay, we find that this the infringement was in fact willful, and the verdict comes out. It's, you know, given out in court, and the parties get to hear it. And Microsoft came back and said, hey, we want to challenge this because we don't want, you know, an assessment of treble damages against us. And what the court did when it was looking in determining whether or not the jury could even come to that conclusion reasonably under the evidence, that the specific language that they use is whether Microsoft knew or should have known that their practices were infringing.
Yeah, so willful in the eyes of the law doesn't actually mean willful. It means willful or absurdly lax in their standards.
Reckless. I mean, here it's closer to a reckless standard, really.
Yeah. So my guess is what would have happened at trial is they either got somebody at Microsoft who had seen the patent to get up on the stand and say, yes, he had seen the patent and was familiar with it, or you get somebody on the stand to talk about the standards at Microsoft or the standards at similar companies to do regular patent searches for the types of things that they're developing. And using that information, the jury would have determined whether or not Microsoft knew about that patent or should have known about the patent.
Well, so before we tie this story off, I mean, there's a few more things that I think we should just hit on real quick. So is it likely that we're going to see Microsoft Word completely come off the shelves in the next 2 months or so when the order becomes, or the permanent injunction becomes effective?
I don't see any other option for Microsoft unless I'm missing something big here. They can't really sell it between now and when they fix that issue. I mean, they could very quickly just disable the DocX feature, but other than that, I don't know how they'd do it. Do you have any ideas, David?
I mean, the real question going forward is whether they have to change the way they actually store those DocXs. And I mean, if on the basis of this patent the DocX is no longer even valid as a format, then they have to go back to some either an old format or some version of this that's no longer infringing. But that would sort of leave all the previous DocXs as orphan formats that, you know, you couldn't really open anymore, and you'd have to convert somehow using, I don't know, IDI or I4I software.
Yeah, that's a clever way of doing it.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because basically now, if let's say that Microsoft changes the software completely, so it has no XML functionality, and in the future, then what happens to all the .docx files that are already out there? You know, from all the previous stuff.
I mean,
the future software then basically can't read the previous software without reading on the patent.
Right. So, I mean, they could try to invent around the patent, like we discussed earlier. But all of the people who currently saved documents in .docx format can still open them up in their current versions of Word and resave them as .doc formats.
That's true.
But
who wants to do that, though, right?
Of course, it is an open standard, so I'm not quite sure if the patent is infringing on the actual format or the way that Microsoft Word actually handles the format, because other programs, you know, such as, I think, Google Docs can actually open DocX documents, and a number of other programs. It might actually be based on the number or on the way that they open the files and not actually them opening the file, or not the actual file format itself. So it might be a non-issue. It might just be a software problem and not a format problem.
I think it's mostly a software problem based on the way that I've read the patent, because what it's describing is a methodology of accessing and reading and writing to the files themselves, and it's not actually trying to patent the underlying. As far as I've read it, maybe there's a broader reading out there, but as far as I read it, it's not actually trying to patent the format itself as a whole. So it's not trying to get at the open standard, but it certainly does raise some questions, though. I mean, so you have an open format out there, and if you have the methodology of reading and writing to that type of a file format, how could you possibly use the open standard without, you know, infringing the patent? I don't think you can.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Just to clarify an earlier comment, the expiration date for this patent should be July 28th, 2015. So that seems to be 17 years from issue, as opposed to... No, never mind. I still don't know what's going on with this patent.
Thank you, Ben, for chiming in there. I appreciate
You're
that.
Welcome.
So, the other, before like I completely tie this off, I mean, the other interesting thing is that maybe that, I mean, Ben, you hit this. This is a huge bargaining chip for the I4I guys, and I do think what you might see is Microsoft just buying out the I4I technology then, so they don't have to deal with this. I'm thinking about it, and what are the costs going to be of them modifying the software and trying to figure out a clever way to get the previous documents, you know, all the DocX formats from the past, to be able to go forward with their future products and stuff and implement everything the right way. Seems like that would cost a ton of development cash, and probably the smarter thing to do is to say, hey, we lost here, and the best thing to do is to, you know, just to acquire either acquire a license between I4I and Microsoft for what will probably be a high dollar amount now, or buy the technology itself. So,
I don't know.
You guys have any thoughts on that real quick? Or
my thought is they already paid 200 and, I don't know, when you add up all of these costs, probably well over $300 million in the end for this. How much more are they willing to spend on this?
Well, Microsoft's biggest guy in the business. I mean, you know, they're the big brown gorilla.
They're a huge company. I don't disagree with that. But if I were the execs at Microsoft, I would be more concerned with burying this company than I would with trying to give them more money or negotiating with them.
I don't know. You got 40. They've got like 40 million or 40 billion in cash reserves, I think. Last I checked, that's not a recent figure. I just pulled it off the top of my head. But I think it would. You know, they'd probably be at this point willing to pay just to let this thing go away.
Okay.
Any final thoughts?
My final thought is it's 17 years from issue as opposed to 20 years from filing. And I finally got that right. Any thoughts, David Liu, before we move on?
I saw that the judge deciding this case had actually worked at a software engineer at some point prior. I could not find whether or not it was at Microsoft.
Oh, that's interesting. He would probably have to recuse himself if it was Microsoft.
Yeah, that's a fair bet.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. So moving on to our next story here, we have, and this will be a quick story too, but I think it's pretty interesting. Basically, as far, I don't know a ton about this, but Ben is going to help me fill in the gaps. There are these two law firms, and at least one of the law firms appears to have hired some sort of website developer, and the developer seems to have possibly copied the website design from another law firm. Now the two law firms are sort of duking it out and claiming copyright infringement back and forth. So do you have more details on this, Ben?
Yep. So the law firm that sued was a 50-lawyer personal injury and asbestos law firm, and they sued a two-lawyer San Diego firm. And the allegation was plagiarizing web content describing the elder abuse practice of the larger company. So the smaller company hired somebody to design their website, and the smaller company, in designing the website, I guess allegedly took the as copy the description of the elder abuse practice.
So was it just the description? Meaning, is this like a chunk of text, or are we actually talking about the formatting of, say, the CSS on the site itself?
The way I read it was actually the text. They used a tool called CopyScape, which is just a website you can go to and plunk in your website, and it'll tell you, it'll go out and use the Google Search API to see what other instances of text on your that website are found elsewhere on in the internet. So,
right. Some of the reports, it seems, described it like it made it sound like they stole the design of the website. But what I've been reading in the last few minutes is leaning more toward they just stole the text.
Okay, well, that's interesting because as we always talk about when we get into copyright, usually the number one question when it comes to these things is, does whatever is at issue fall within the realm of copyrightable subject matter? And that simply requires a original piece of expression, basically. And usually if you have a description like this, I mean, there's almost no question, you know, the first person who created that bit of text, it's probably going to be original, right?
Yeah, unless the description is so basic that there's no other way to describe it, and that's called merger when you've got the merger of the idea and the description. I'm trying to think of a good simple example of this, but
if it's too factual, right? I mean, if you're describing like very factual things, like our site provides the following services, and you have no other way to describe those services, it's basically, you know, it's pretty factual in the end of the day, right?
Right, that's a good example.
Like if it were a pure list that did not, you know, something that had quick bullet points, like I think how you could tie it into elder law. I know a lot about elder law. Intellectual property law. You know, if you say our firm provides the following services, and then you say copyright infringement services, patent prosecution services, trademark prosecution services, so on and so forth. I mean, that's very factual right there. It's not very original. Maybe the layout could possibly be original, but the text itself is mostly
factual. And then you have cases like Google and Bing where, you know, they both have the same search bar. They both say search web, search images, search video, and it's pretty much the same thing, but it's just factual content, and I don't believe Google is suing Bing for their similar layout.
Indeed, to the best of our knowledge, they are not. However, as we discussed on an earlier podcast, Kayak is none too happy about Microsoft Bing's travel search engine. That being said,
I think you cut out there, Ben.
Okay.
I don't know. It was just garbled. But So we have the Kayak thing that's going on too. The Kayak website is the creators of the Kayak website are suing Microsoft for part of its Bing search engine. They claim it's too similar in design, with those types of layout things. But anyways, that's not at issue here, so I think we could just put that past us. So is there anything, what's going on in this case now?
So what happened was the firms agreed to submit to arbitration, and what happened at arbitration was arbitration is just it's a slightly less formal way of settling these cases. You usually get a lawyer or an ex-judge who's now in retirement. He hears the case, hears arguments as law, and enters a binding opinion in it, in the case. And federal law is very tilted toward encouraging arbitration as opposed to litigation through federal courts. So once an arbitration decision comes down, it's very hard to get it overturned because you don't want to be wasting the court's time with something that people agreed on how they wanted to settle it. And in this case, the arbitrator decided that he was going to split the liability, two-thirds for the web development company and one-third to the law firm. And an issue that came up was that the law firm at no point – I don't think there was any allegation that the law firm had any part in that infringement. But they were still slapped with a third of the liability.
So that's the kind of the I think the interesting point here is if you hire somebody to develop a website for you and – whatever that person who is developing it ends up creating something that's potentially infringing, who's the liable party there? And what are the chances you have?
Okay, David, you just fuzzed out there, but I think we got the bulk of that, which is who's liable for this copying? And it really depends on how that relationship is set up. If they're an employee of your, let's say, you know, it's Microsoft, and Microsoft's in-house person copies something off of Google's website, then Microsoft as a company would be liable. But when you're farming it out to a third person, the liability is a bit more murky.
Murky? You want to go a little further than that?
Yes. So we were talking a few weeks ago about works for hire. So something can be a work for hire under the Copyright Act if the person does it in their employ, as part of their employment, like that Microsoft case. If the person who creates the work is doing it as part of a larger kind of compiled work, like let's say they write a poem as a work for hire and submit it to the company, that company would own the copyright in it, just like Microsoft would own the copyright in the work that its employees did. And also, it can be a work for hire if the contract specifies that it's a work for hire. And in this case, we don't have the contract. I couldn't find it. So we don't know what that relationship really was. And who knows, for a very small law firm like this, they may not have had a specific contract with the guy. They may have just agreed that he'd developed the website orally. And when that happens, it's a really tough decision as to who to hold liable and in what proportion.
So probably the takeaway advice here is you want to be pretty careful when you're hiring somebody to develop a website for you and make sure that they are not copying or coming close to copying somebody else's content, right?
Absolutely. Be very careful when doing these things. Is all we can say. You know, don't copy other people's work. It's not worth it.
And David, you mentioned CopyScate, and could you just go over that really quick? Because that sounded pretty interesting. Is it basically some type of API where you can search other people's websites for plagiarized content, basically?
So CopyScate is a website that actually anybody can use, although I do believe they offer premium services as well. But you just put in the URL of any website, and it'll tell you where certain phrases from that website appear on other sites. So I actually checked CopyScape to see if you guys were infringing anything on the Technically Legal page.
And oh, great.
It did come up with a number of hits for things, but most of it was the quotes that you had on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So you actually posted a couple snippets from there, and they showed up on various websites like the Missouri Bar and stuff. So, you know, it's not a foolproof service, but it is one way to find out where your text is appearing in other places on the web.
So I'm trying to use this right now, and I'm a little unsure. If I type in technicallylegal.org, is it going to tell me who's copying me or who I'm copying?
They don't actually make claims on which way the copying goes. All that they say is text from this page also appeared on this page. So it's kind of symmetrical blame until
okay. They
leave that to you.
Oh, that's pretty cool, actually. I like that.
Yeah. And for the record, you cannot actually infringe copyrights on, well, the government does not have a copyright in any works produced by the government, so we were not infringing any copyrights by posting excerpts of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Right. I didn't mean to imply that.
Thanks for that disclaimer, Ben. I think we all appreciate that.
That was more for the education of the readers who, don't know if you can, I don't know, post government statutes without being slapped by a copyright infringement suit from the government.
Apparently, Copyscape has been used in a number of other cases as well. I guess back in 2005, there was a Norwegian web developer who made a CSS tutorial and then found it on the official Apple site somewhere.
Oh, okay. Well, that's pretty cool, too. Good to see that it's being used around, I guess. So we should move on to the final case, because it's a big case, possibly even larger than the Microsoft case, if you can believe it. Basically, this is the Real Networks, and Real Networks, they have created the Real Player, and they also have created this software called Real DVD. They have been embroiled in this lawsuit for, I think, since mid-2007, actually early 2007, it looks like, since around March. And basically what happened, to summarize, is that Real Networks filed a lawsuit seeking what's called declaratory judgment against approximately six movie studios and content providers. And what they were trying to seek is that this new software, which the Real DVD software, which basically allows a person to take a DVD and make a copy of it onto their hard drive. They were seeking to show that the software was, in fact, still within the bounds of the law, not violating any portions of the Copyright Act or any other licensing agreements that were between the content creation studios and any additional parties. And we'll sort of get into that because that's one of the dicier parts of the case. And it came down this week that a preliminary injunction has been issued in the suit. And usually a preliminary injunction is something that kind of shows whether there's a strong likelihood of one of the parties ultimately winning in the suit or not. So, Ben, do you want to add anything about this?
Just to say that the standard for a preliminary injunction is substantial likelihood of success, which does, depending on who you ask and what judge at what time, not necessarily a strong likelihood. In my opinion, you'll find a preliminary injunction issues when there are good arguments that it should happen. The arguments need to be non-frivolous. It doesn't have to be a really strong case. It just has to be a not absurdly weak case.
So does that go to the law or the facts? I mean, because, whenever you have a lawsuit, you essentially have disputed factual issues, and then sometimes you have disputed legal points.
It goes to both. I mean, obviously, if the law isn't on your side, did I just cut out there for a second?
Yep.
You're good, though. Okay. So obviously, if the law's not on your side, you're not going to win that case. But there's also some amount of factual development that happens before the preliminary injunction. It varies how much there is, but that will also have an effect. In this case, you go.
Yeah. No. Keep going.
In this case, most of the facts that were developed, there was some testimony. But most of it was stuff that was undisputed. It was how CSS works, that's the DVD copying scheme, how Real DVD worked, what the license agreements were between the parties, that kind of thing.
Okay, so first of all, if Dominic was here, I'm sure he'd be chiming in and saying, oh, this is another one of those beautiful things under the law where you see a company that files a suit to prevent being sued by the other party, and that's sort of the essence of a declaratory judgment, at least in this circumstance here. And so sort of getting to the complicated licensing issue, so what is CSS and how is it licensed and who is it licensed to?
The DVD Copy Control Association has the exclusive license for CSS. Is allowed to grant licenses for CSS. CSS is a copy encryption scheme that was developed by a DVD consortium to prevent people from copying DVDs, which was cracked in an absurdly short period of time and then published all over the internet and on ties and t-shirts.
And in song.
And in song. Let's not forget song. So all DVD players and all computers that have DVD drives and the software that play it have access to this CSS key so it can decrypt the DVD and play it.
Okay, so the ability to decode or at least to read through the CSS basically is essential to getting at the content that's on the DVD. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So what happens here? We have these six defendants, and they've been licensed to CSS?
So the way I understand it is that Real had actually, you know, they have their license for using this technology to decode the DVDs since they had been making DVD players for a while. And then they, I believe, tried to use that license to allow users to make copies of the DVDs and save them on their computer, which seems like a good idea. And they were actually promoting this as the legit way to do DVD ripping because they had the license as opposed to other programs that do the same thing. And they were adding additional restraints on their the ability to actually, you know, do different things with these DVDs. So really, it was just a method to save it, which they thought was going to be useful.
It turns out they were wrong. Yeah, the DVD consortium was not pleased with this. And an interesting thing about that is that in the opinion, the judge seems to rely somewhat heavily on the fact that this does nothing to prevent people from renting a DVD, using the software to rip the DVD to their hard drives, and then returning the rented DVD. I mean, and to be clear, the judge rested significantly on law and other, you know, more relevant areas, but the judge seemed unduly concerned with the fact that while this was a very safe way and a very rigid way of backing up your DVDs and watching them on a limited number of computers after paying through the nose to get licenses to watch your own DVDs on your own computer and rent, the judge was very concerned with the fact that it could not distinguish between a borrowed DVD or a rented DVD and a DVD that the person owns.
So Real Networks, basically, they tried to say that our copying of the content on DVDs still preserves the CSS, and so it's still essentially protected, right?
They did.
I think that was one of their core arguments. And so basically what they're trying to say is, like, hey, we have a way that we think is legal for you to make backup copies of your DVDs. It doesn't allow you to make a perfect copy of a DVD. It's not like you could take, you know, as it's raw on your hard drive after using the software. It's not like you could take that file and then turn it into another DVD and make a copy of a DVD, right?
Right. That was a
limit. I mean, that goes to the technical limitations, right?
Right. It does. That was their own way of trying to make the DVD consortium happy with this.
So how does it violate the Copyright Act?
In what way doesn't it violate the Copyright Act, I think is the better question. So not only was there this CSS technology that that we've already talked about, there was also another anti-copying technology, and I'm blanking on the name. It's ASCOM? What was it? Does anyone know what I'm talking about?
I've heard of it, and I can't remember the name.
It's somewhere in this opinion, and I'm scrolling really slowly and can't find it. David, do you happen to know what this is? This is,
Is it Arcos and Ripguard?
Yes, those are it, Arcos and Ripguard. So what those do is, it's little, basically skips that they put in and bad data that they put inside the DVD. And this is only in a fraction of the DVDs that are sold. I think it's something in between the two of them, a little more than a tenth of the top 300 DVDs that were sold in the past year. So it has not gained wide acceptance, but Real spent a great deal of time figuring out how to essentially get around this, how to make it easier for computers to copy it. Because what it does is, since it introduces these kind of bad areas in the DVD, the DVD players will get to it in a computer. They'll get to it, kind of pause, stutter, try to read it, keep on trying to read it, and then eventually move on. And it will end up making it take a lot longer to copy this off the DVD. So that was another way that the DVD consortium protects these DVDs, and ended up being another reason why this software was illegal, or was found to violate the Copyright Act. Specifically, what it violated, though, I mean, it it arguably violates just the sheer copying part of the Copyright Act, but it also, and I think more importantly, violates the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And it
okay.
Yes.
Stop right there. Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, what we want to get at here. And so we have the old exclusive rights under the Copyright Act, the things that the owner of content is allowed to, exclusively do, meaning that if you're somebody else, you generally have to be authorized by the content holder to do these things. And that's, copying and distributing, and there are a couple of other ones. But in this case, copying is the big one, making an actual reproduction of the work. And are there any ways that we might be able to do that, for personal purposes?
Yeah, in the opinion, the judge alluded to the fact that it would perhaps be fair use for a person to make a copy of it, make a copy of a DVD they owned and keep a backup on their computer. Did that get to the heart of your question?
It does. I mean, so, why should I not be allowed to make up a backup copy of the DVD onto my computer?
So the judge says you are allowed to do it. You're just not allowed to violate the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, in doing it. And specifically, Real Networks isn't allowed to traffic in a program that does it. And that just means they aren't allowed to sell a program that violates the DMCA, that helps people violate the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
So what is the anti-circumvention provision of the DMCA?
They're actually,
I think it's almost notorious at this point, but... Yeah.
So this violated two provisions of the DMCA. The anti-circumvention provision says that you can't circumvent anything that
effectively controls access to a copyright.
Thank you for having the statute in front of you right then.
That was off the top of my head, actually.
Oh, burn. Yes, no person shall circumvent a technology measure that effectively controls access to the work protected under this title being the Copyright Act. So it's important there. So what CSS does is it effectively controls access to the work. It prevents you from reading that file. It prevents you from, looking at that image. What those other two technologies do is violate Section 1201B of the DMCA, which is a copy protection means. It makes it harder for you to copy. And the judge found in this case that it was an effective copy protection, and therefore this program that helped you get around this copy protection violated it.
So here's, I think, where one of the most interesting parts of the lawsuit comes up. So Real Networks basically had authorization to they had the CSS decryption key, and they were able to read the DVDs, and they were licensed to do that. But what they were not authorized to do is to read the DVDs and then create software that additionally copied the content on the DVD onto a hard drive. And that's the portion that actually violated the DMCA.
Yes, it seems, I don't know, I was reading some other opinions on this that were saying that, I guess it's a little unrelated, but that it's goes further than the fact that Real DVD was distributing this method, but... based on what they actually said in the DMCA, that you're not allowed to do it at all. So I guess the question is it just the Real DVD, or is it any program that is able to do this?
Any program. But I think why this group of content holders was so interested in this is because they were Real DVD was a piece of software that was being sold and commercialized. I think they're selling them for about $30 a pop. And there's a lot of other free software out there I think you can use that will do exactly this. But
Handbrake. Excuse me, I had something in my throat.
Go.
I was just listing through a cough one piece of software that may or may not do that.
However, that's distributed from overseas, I believe, so the DMCA does not apply to it.
Yes, it is. It's also open source, so it's very hard to nail any one person as being responsible for it. And
right.
Just to be clear, even if it's distributed from overseas, if I download that piece of software and use it, I'm still violating the DMCA. It's just that the people who make it probably... No, they would still be liable for trafficking in the software. It's just difficult to prosecute them.
Once it enters into the U.S. and once it's effectively doing anything under the anti-circumvention provision, which could be... where you could be civilly liable or criminally liable, I mean, it still violates it, no matter what, no matter where you are.
Right.
So anyways, moving on in this thing here, what does this mean in the end of the day? I mean, basically, this preliminary injunction has been issued. Everyone has described this as a huge blow to the litigation. What does this mean for everybody else that wants to be able to make copies of their DVDs for personal backup purposes?
Excuse me, getting over a cough here. It means that people are still going to have to resort to either illegal means of making backups of their DVDs and watching them on their hard drive, or wait until the rest of the industry catches up with, I think, two movies that I've gotten recently, one from Pixar and one from Warner Brothers, have included secure digital copies with the DVD. And, you know, that's good. I like being able to have a digital copy of the movie I just bought, but I shouldn't have to wait for the studio to give me one. I should just be able to legally take my DVD and make a copy of it and put it on my computer so I can watch it. And that's what this is doing. It's dealing a huge blow to people just getting their content the way they want it.
That's what really bugs me about this, is that it's pretty clear that these guys want to control every single possible medium that they can to distribute their content in. And it's no longer the case that, you know, everything sort of comes out in one or two types of mediums, and then you can do whatever you want with it after it. It's now, well, we want to control the, you know, the digital file that we might send you. So either if it's being streamed, or if we actually we're sending you an entire file, we also want to control the DVDs. And you know, does that bother you guys too?
It definitely bothers me, and I'm curious of the implications that has on the other sort of medias. I mean, I've been making copies of my CDs for some time, and should I be deleting them now? Because I mean, it doesn't get around any sort of copy protection, but it is essentially the same idea, no?
Well, so you've got two things going on. You have the exclusive rights under the Copyright Act. So if you're, you know, violating one of those, and usually the one we're talking about here is the right to reproduce. If you're reproducing a copyrighted work, you might still be okay under just the general fair use provisions. The sticky point that comes in is when it does have something like a DRM type protection on it, and you are able to circumvent that when you're doing the reproduction, that's when you're violating the Anti-Circumvention Act. And within the anti-circumvention provision of the DMCA, I mean, and within that particular provision, it has this little phrase, I think, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, so Ben can correct me here, but it basically says, notwithstanding the fair use provisions under the other portions of the Copyright Act, if you try to circumvent one of these technical means of control, you're violating the Copyright Act. So it's a way that sort of almost kills fair use a little bit, because if you put any type of software onto something that is copyrighted that would control the access, regardless of how effective it is in the end of the day, if you try to get around that, you're violating the Copyright Act.
Right. 1201C does say that nothing in this section shall affect, among other things, fair use. But in the opinion that the judge issued, she was very clear that, you know, Real Networks tried to assert fair use, saying that, you know, this is a fair use end. And the judge said, yes, it's very possibly a fair use end, but it was not a means. The means by which you got to it was still prohibited by the DMCA, kind of killing any type of fair use defense, at least in front of that judge.
So if you have older DVDs or even older CDs that don't have any DRM protection on it, and you're making backup copies for your own personal use, under most circumstances, you know, fair use might apply there, and it's, you know, it might not be infringement in the end of the day. I mean, you can't say absolutely whether it is or it isn't infringement. That's just sort of the nature of how the Copyright Act works. But, you know, in general, general space shifting is okay, or place shifting sometimes is okay too.
Yeah, I mean, that's accurate. Obviously, don't go out and start copying stuff willy-nilly. But there's a fair bet that, one, if you do make personal copies of your own CDs for personal backup use, you're not going to be prosecuted because they don't care about you. And two, even if you are prosecuted, I'd say it's very likely fair use. And there's been a lot of dicta that we've seen. Dicta is judges commenting on things, but it's not binding. to any courts. There's been a lot of that recently, indicating that even going online and downloading off of a peer-to-peer network a CD that you already own may be fair use as a form of backing it up.
Maybe, yeah, maybe, but I wouldn't take that argument to heart.
No, that was in Judge Gertner's opinion about her motion denying. It was a judgment, judgment as a matter of law on the Tenenbaum's fair use defense that she mentioned that as a possible fair use.
Yeah, I did see that too. So, do you know anything about the Clyde Escape case, Ben?
A little bit. So, in the Clyde. For those of you who don't know, Kaleidoscape is an extraordinarily expensive system that it's got a DVD player. You pop in the DVD, it will copy the DVD onto a hard drive and serve as like a movie jukebox. Last I checked, these things run like $20,000 at the base unit. Kaleidoscape was sued for violating the same license agreement that Real Networks entered into, and they won their first stage of it on essentially a contract technicality, and I'm not that familiar with the contract technicality, and in this case, the judge went out of her way to, in the Real Networks case, the judge was very careful to say that she's not applying that technicality here.
Right, so that was one of the big things that the Real Networks guys had argued. They said, well, you know, in the Kaleidoscape case, which was another California case, both these cases are in the California court system currently, and they said, well, the Kaleidoscape basically, a judge ruled that copying in this sort of method does not violate the CSS license between the content holders and other people, and it was speaking mostly to the sort of breach of contract claim, which gets a little dicey, but I think what happened here is that the judge came back and said, I'm not going to apply that because it was mostly on this small technicality, and that's what sort of hurt the Real Networks guys the most.
Right.
So, do you guys have any further thoughts on this? I mean, what's left in the litigation? I mean, this is still pretty preliminary stuff. This was, after all, a preliminary injunction that was issued, and it's not an actual final ruling. Do you have any predictions?
I just want to mention one thing. Kaleidoscape decision, and I'm trying to see, this was also issued this week, was recently overturned, but I can't seem to find by whom, by what court. Oh, appellate court. It was overturned by an appellate court. I haven't gotten a chance to read that opinion. I was out of town this weekend, but yes, so that opinion may no longer be good law, but I'm not sure.
So, I mean, at the time, I think that Real Networks had argued that it was still good law, and then now it looks like I'm reading the same post, I think, that you are. It looks like it's been completely overturned anyways. So Kaleidoscape has its own legal problems, too.
Right, but yeah, I'm not sure on what grounds it was overturned. And it looks like it was overturned the day after the Real DVD case came out. So, you know, Real DVD was on Real Networks was on solid ground when they were citing that, even though it wasn't binding on the court.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, David, any thoughts? David Liu, I'm going for this time.
No.
That's fair. Anything else?
So no, I mean, what's left in the litigation? Or you think this is going to continue to go forward? Do you think the parties are going to try to settle at this point?
I'd be surprised if they settle at this point. So all they have left now is a trial and appeals. And it seems like they already have a lot of the factual record developed for any potential trial. So my guess is it will either be a bench trial in short order, and a bench trial is when there isn't a jury, or there'll be a jury trial within the next year, and then Real Networks at that point will decide possibly whether or not to appeal it. It's hard to say how much longer this is going on. I don't particularly see them settling at this point or just rolling over and giving up.
Well, I guess we'll see. I mean, it could still be the case, even though the injunction was issued, that after the trial, things might go the other way. But I guess we'll have to see in due time, right?
Absolutely.
So hopefully we'll see an end to this case sometime in the near future, and we'll be sure to report back on it on our website. So I think that's it for the week, and we're pretty much done with all the stories. Thanks for tuning in. Once again, I was your host, David O'Brien, and with me today,
Ben Snitkoff
and David Liu.
Be sure to check back next week for the next edition of Technically Legal. Thanks for listening.